6th chapter of 3rd Nephi, and everybody says at this point, well, this is where I came in. I mean, we've got to go through this again. It starts out, notice, everything is lovely at the beginning. There are people, the Nephites all return to their own lands. Happy ending, it starts out that way. They still had plenty of provision left. It wasn't 7 years. It wasn't even 6 years. And they returned to their own lands, and everything was lovely. 1945. And they rehabilitated the robbers. They granted them the robbers' covenant, and they even granted them lands to settle, as far as that goes, and to subsist, and thus they did establish peace in the land. They not only rehabilitated the robbers, they gave them lands. That was their trouble. That's the only way they'd make a living otherwise. And they began to prosper and wax great. Now, this is a post-war boom that is a beauty. They really flourish because everything has to be built up again. There's a great demand for everything, and everything starts to flourish magnificently. A boom. You see, many cities were built anew. All this reconstruction to be done. Many old cities were repaired. The inner structures were restored, what we call the infrastructures had broken down, and they were repaired. Notice the Book of Mormon is right up to times in these things. You not only build new cities, you have to repair the old ones, and that's where the big expense goes. And many highways cast up, great road building. See, that's what happened after World War II. We didn't have any freeways. We didn't have any I-15 or anything like that. There were none of those roads in the country at all until after World War II. And then came this, many highways are cast up, many roads from city to city. And this is a very vivid picture of the culture as we actually know it was. But then there began to be some disputings among the people and pride and boasting because of their exceeding great riches. Do we have to go through this again, you see? There's only 3 years, and this is beginning to happen. Now, notice they have a Byzantine civilization, a very efficient Byzantine. Almost all ancient civilizations were formed like this. That is, by Byzantine, you mean you have various classes with various uniforms and various insignias, various preparations, educations, and so forth in Rome. If you were a member of the conscript patres, you wore a toga. You didn't if you were not. If you were a member of the plebs, you didn't. And if you were a workman, you wore a brown. You had to wear a sort of russet brown garment. If you were a little higher up, business and so forth, you wore a purple tinge to it. If you were an official, you wore the toga clavata, if with a rim around the border or a red fringe. And so it goes. And if you were the big cheese, then you would wear a toga picta. And these things to distinguish them all. Remember Julius Caesar, you all know Julius Caesar from high school, who says, "What know you not? You ought not walk upon a holiday without the sign of your profession." You had to wear the sign of your profession at all times, you see. And he's there talking about workmen. Oh, being mechanical. "What know ye not, being mechanical, ye ought not walk upon a holiday without the sign of your profession." If you're a workman, you had to have a sign of your profession. It was so here too, notice. And they began to be divided by ranks according to their riches and their chances for learning. I say this is the Byzantine, an efficient, over-organized type of civilization in the yuppie world. Some were ignorant because of their poverty. Others received great learning because of their riches. Today, for the first time, money is regarded actually as the principle for which you, the purpose for which a person wants to be educated today, because you make more money that way. And they did receive learning because they have this warped view of things. Instead of scholarship as a life of austerity and doing without, so that you can have the real fun. And they were lifted up in pride, and others were exceeding humble. And then, this happens very rapidly. There came a great inequality in all the land, insomuch that the church began to be broken up. Broken up how? Well, in the 12th and 13th verses, into the rich and the poor, of course. They're redistributing the wealth, all right. The rich get more, and the poor get less, and that's redistributing it as we are doing it today. Many statistics today, steadily for the last 10 years, so that drift has been very marked in this country, the separation between the rich and the poor. Well, we don't need to recite them, but some other things I'm going to read to you now anyway. And the church began to be broken up. The church couldn't take that, you see. There were a few among the Lamanites that survived. The church can't survive inequality. You notice this is a very interesting thing. In ancient times, the same way. Few among the Lamanites stuck to the true faith. They were firm and steadfast. What can it refer to? Stuck to the true faith, firm and stead, can only refer to the law of consecration, as far as I can see, the doctrine. They're immovable, willing in all diligence to keep the commandments. See, that's what they read. They keep the commandments. It's not doctrine. They were not true to, wasn't a, they gave a different interpretation to doctrine, but they kept the commandments, and the others didn't. No. And now here it sums it all up. Here's the whole thing, and these are the four things, again, we've talked about before. Notice the 15th verse. You want to know what caused all this? Now, the cause of this iniquity, it tells us, was this. Iniquity of the people was this, that lays it right down on the line here. Satan had great power unto stirring up the people to do all manner of iniquity, to the puffing them up with pride, tempting them to seek for power and authority and riches and the vain things of the world. See, this is exactly, this is your prime time. See, power is what they all want. That's the big game today. But they go with riches. Of course, you have to have the means. And the two go together, and authority and riches and the vain things of the world. So, now, the only virtue to the stuff I write is that I quote some good things. I've got some good quotes, and that makes them rather useful reference books for some things or other. They're interlarded with the tripe that I put in, but this is... Now here, there's some very good stuff here I just happened to notice in this book that's just out. It's not available yet. It's going to stir a lot of people up when it does come out. Where do we get here? That this happened so fast. We're talking about that this should happen. Remember, the commentator keeps telling us here all the time, isn't it amazing that this happened so soon, that it happened so quickly? In the space that tells us right here of not... not more than 6 years, all this change came about. It's amazing. And so, Daniel Yergin, a famous economist, writes, there is increasing doubt among economists that anything can be done about anything. If that wisdom is correct, then any solution to poverty becomes far more difficult and painful. They cannot be financed out of a growth dividend, but only by redistributing what others already have, in turn creating massive social unrest. Most utopians did that very thing, you see. Before 1974-75, as recently as that, before 1974-1975, mini depression, all financial poverty could have been eliminated at a modest shift of $10 to $15 billion to the poor from the rest of the community. $15 billion is less than 1.5% of the GNP and about the size of one of the cheaper weapons systems, but we didn't do it. Our society is now, this is not going to, our society has gone out of the way not to do what could be done to solve the problem. Why? A community which can, at tolerable expense, eliminate human distress, but refrains from doing so, either must believe that its benefits from unemployment or poverty, or that the poor and unemployed are bad people, or that other more important values will be impaired by attempts to help the lower orders, or all of these statements. Now, this is Robert Heilbronner says this, and he's considered the most eminent economic historian today. Many people consider him that. He says, no other civilization had permitted the calculus of self-interest so to dominate its culture. It has transmogrified greed and philistinism into social virtues, and subordinated all values to commercial values. He's going to tell us the very same thing here. Book of Mormon, they did the same reversal of values here. The Umwertung der Wertung, as Nietzsche calls it. And subordinated all values to commercial values. Now, Thomas More wrote his famous Utopia in 1015, and he was one of the most eminent men of the time, one of the great merchants. He's in Holland and England. As you know, a very important figure, the movie Thomas More and so forth. And here, Thomas More writes in his Utopia, what was heretofore passed as unjust, they have turned upside down, and in fact proclaimed it publicly and by law to be nothing less than justice itself. And that's exactly what Ivan Boisky proclaimed when he recently commended a healthy greed as a high virtue to college audiences. Of course, he's in jail now. The complete inversion of utopian ideal is reached when success itself becomes synonymous with money, which of course it does. That's exactly what we're reading about here in this very precise and concise and to the point discussion in the Book of Mormon. It hits it right on the head. This doesn't describe Joseph Smith's world at all. This isn't the kind of community he lived at all. This goes back to ancient times, to other times, but it certainly is coming awfully close to home now. And what is the end result? The old familiar picture. A citizen of New York writes, you have to be on the alert constantly to sense when somebody is nearby is out of place. Waiting, looking, ready to pounce. You have to clutch your handbag up close, ready to fight for it should it become necessary. You have to put three locks on your door, plus a burglar-proof chain. You have to avoid the subways night or day, and don't smile at strangers on the bus. What a way to live, you see. Still, the writer is determined to hang on. She says, I can't accept a lifestyle that makes us weary of community or civility, where human beings have to take on the attributes of jungle animals in order to protect themselves, in order to live. Foreigners coming to this city from the Eastern Europe hail it as an earthly paradise. That's New York, she's not writing now. A utopia, which only goes to show that anyone can adjust to anything. But our writer objects, something inside me says that I will die if I accommodate to this way of living. The Lord has got to put an end to it, and this is what we're going to have very soon in the Book of Mormon with a big bang. Is this an exaggeration? Every day coming to school, I walk here and there, down to 8th North, 7th North, where I live, and up to here. Every day I pass these signs on the along by the canal and so forth. Do not walk in this area after dark for your own safety. And this is Zion. You see, you can't even take a stroll in the dark. Great guns. In Athens a few years ago, we lived down in a flea bag. It was not bad, down just two blocks from the Acropolis, at the base of the Acropolis, and there was this little Byzantine church and a place where the buses turn around there. It's the end of the line. It's the end of Athena Street there. Very busy and so forth. And you could go out any time of day or night. Phyllis had to go out to the drugstore at 3 o'clock in the morning, perfectly safe. And this is the tough part of town, by the flea market. I left a suitcase on the curb there where you get off the bus and went to town, forgot all about it. And the next morning at 10 o'clock, I had to go up to the university. I said, well, it's gone. I went by there at 10 o'clock. There was the suitcase standing on the curb. Nobody had touched it. And this was the toughest part of town. I mean, this is where the flea market was and everything else. Perfectly safe. The last day we were there that time, I got some yogurt at a place. It's in the open market there. A farm woman bought it from the farm. Goat's cheese, what it was. And I walked over a mile getting back to where I was in the hotel and so forth. And here came this little old lady. She chased me all the way. I'd overpaid her about 10 cents. She had to pay it back to me. She followed me all over town so she could pay back this 10 cents that I overpaid. And we don't do like that here at all. You can see why those ancient civilizations have survived. Suffer they have, but they will survive. Well, the same thing here. He says, this is Zion to which we have become accustomed for the sake of the economy. It's the same fantastic situation confronting all utopians. Well, here we might quote Simon of Athens, when he leaves Athens. Now, Timon of Athens was the richest man in Athens and extremely generous, and he gave his money to everybody, helped everybody. And by doing so, he lost his wealth. He didn't keep good track of it. He was too generous, and he went broke. And all his friends just cut him. They wouldn't recognize him in the street or anything else. First, he went around trying to get loans, trying to get nothing. They'd never heard of him and so forth. They all had good excuses. Well, I'd like to help you, but this, that, and the other. So he got no help from them, and so he becomes a misanthrope. As a misanthrope, he leaves the town. He goes out to live on roots outside the city. He's not going to have any more of that. And he pronounces a curse on the city as he leaves. Let me look back on thee, O thou wall that guardest in those wolves. Bankrupts, hold fast rather than render back. Out with your knives, cut your trusters' throats. Bound servants, steal. Large-handed robbers your grave masters are, and pill by law. See, a servant should just filch around the house and steal as he can. He has a perfect right because his master, his grave master, steals in the grand manner. He's the real thief because he steals by law. You see, that's all arranged. So he talks about that, and then he has that wonderful soliloquy on money, which I won't recite at this time, but it's money can do anything is the idea. And so Stammen's whole argument is that money creates values that do not exist. Confound contraries, he said, and thus gives us the completely phony world. We've mentioned this before. So here we have it, here in the Book of Mormon. And it really pours it on here, makes it very clear what these things were because of their riches. What's going to happen? Well, and Satan, the 16th verse here, and thus Satan did lead away the hearts of the people to do all manner of iniquity. Therefore, they had enjoyed peace but a few years. Notice he keeps coming in. How could this happen so fast, you see? The pace of it. The eighth verse here. Seven and eight right across the way here. Yes, it says in the eighth verse, the next chapter. And thus 6 years had not passed away since the more part of the people had turned from righteousness, like a dog to his vomit. How can it pass? Well, it does. These things hit us fast. And it says that they came the me-first philosophy. I want it now, and I want it all. What was the 17th verse? Space of a long time to be carried about by the temptations of the devil, whithersoever he desired to carry them, to do whatever iniquity they desired they should. Thus, the commencement of this year, the 30th year, they were in a state of awful wickedness. After just those few, going from awful wickedness, it began, remember, by telling us back in 5 and 3 here, preceding verse, the story starts out, and they did forsake all their sins. As it starts out, there wasn't a living soul among all the Nephites 5 years before that who did doubt in the least the words of the holy prophets. And they knew that it must be that Christ had come already, and they did forsake all their sins and abominations and whoredoms. And now they're already back and in a state of awful wickedness. Now that is a real flip-flop. But you can do those things. It's amazing how fast they can take place. And then what happens? Of course, something has to happen now. They did not sin ignorantly. They did willfully rebel against God. Well, we've seen that. They had just been righteous people. They knew what they were doing. How can that happen? You may have read Sam Butler's novel, The Way of All Flesh. They're not read much in schools now. It's a great novel on that sort of thing. A man who was very strict, upright, and so forth, just in one event, by one experience, completely, became completely lost everything because of this misadventure. And these things happen, you see. Sin once, one good sin, and you say, what the hell, I'm, as Macbeth says, I might as well go all the way now. I'm stepped in blood so far that should I wade no more, return would be as tedious as go o'er, so I might as well go on. And so people do that. They did not sin ignorantly now. And this is exactly what Heilbrunner was talking about and what Thomas More was talking about here. They make a virtue of what they are doing. Ayn Rand, for years, was the most popular author by far here in the bookstore. They sell more of her books than any other. And her books had such titles as The Virtue of Selfishness and The Evil of I was going to say philanthropy, that isn't the word she uses. But that selfishness was a virtuous thing, and to be a... to be too generous was a fault. Because, of course, if you take care of yourself, then you're taking care of everything else. Then the economy will take care of it. Well, this is the basic philosophy today, you see. It's the virtue of selfishness. And Laconius filled the judgment seat of his father at that time. And so there has to be a reaction here. Not just objector, but something must cut in. God couldn't just leave things here. And so men began to be inspired from heaven and sent forth and preaching against these things boldly. And it goes too far, this happens, people thought, but they get in trouble. These men got in real trouble, you see. They were, they couldn't just laugh at them. Notice this 27th verse, many, the people became exceeding angry. And the important was the chief judges, the ones in high places. The chief judges who had been high priests and lawyers, and all those who were lawyers were angry. Notice it keeps hammering away at the lawyers. They're the ones that take over when a society reaches this stage of depravity. It becomes a world of lawyers. And they were the liars, and they didn't like this kind of talk at all. And then what's going to happen? Now, there was a law, it was part of the Constitution here. The part of the Constitution. that nobody could be put to death unless there was a warrant signed by the governor. Of course, there's a death warrant, you have to go up the top. He had the power to reprieve, and he had the power to, and he had to sign the warrant, the death warrant. But they didn't, the judges and the lawyers didn't like these people that were preaching, so they put them out of the way anyway. They had ways of getting around that. That was their business. And many who testified of these things of, as to Christ were taken and put to death secretly by the judges. Legally, but secretly, you see, because there the judges make it legally. And then no knowledge was known until after their death. It was a fait accompli, too bad. There's nothing we can do about it now. This was, in other words, it's sometimes necessary to go beyond the law, as von Halle says. And so they did, to get rid of these people. Well, now, this is very serious, and people started noting this and started declaring that this was unconstitutional. And a complaint came to the governor against these judges. There were people, so they were going to be indicted. They were indicted. The complaint was made officially to the governor, and so these judges and lawyers were going to be indicted for them, what they'd been up to, and they weren't going to put up with that, you see. They were going to be noticed. They're not only indicted, they were tried and convicted, the 26th verse. They were brought up to be judged of the crime they've done. But no, sir, they weren't going to be convicted because they had a position of strength. 27. Now it came to pass those judges had many friends and kindreds, and remained all, and almost all the lawyers and high priests had gathered together. Remember, we're told this is a Byzantine society where you belong in a particular class. It says they were divided into classes, and they wore a particular garment and had a particular rank, and they were members of the same order, and so they stuck together. And that's what they're doing here. They're showing great solidarity here. And they had many friends and kindreds. Almost all the lawyers, it says here, and the high priests gather together and unite with the kindreds of the judges, these rich, influential people of the establishment. We read about them. There was such an establishment, see, here in verse 12. People began to be distinguished by ranks according to riches for their learning and so forth. So they formed definite groups of society. But it goes much beyond that. We forget that far more important than the national state, anciently and today too, are the subgroups, the groups it's divided into, our classes, interest groups, whether in business, academics, and so forth, and, of course, the tribes. All the cities were divided into deans and fratries, into smaller groups, and they were the one you belonged to. That's so with any tribes of Indians or anything else. You talk about the Hopis. Well, if you're a Hopi, what are you? Are you of the Snake Clan? Are you the Turtle Clan? What are you, of the Bear Clan? That makes all the difference. That's where all the ordinances, that's where all the secrets go in this particular group. And these people are divided the same way as our society is. Our real business is done in little groups, in confidential groups and bodies. We come to agreement about things. We have certain things in common. Well, merely political parties, as that goes. Political extremists, for example, will form bodies that are closely knit and extremist and set themselves apart from the whole rest of the society. They're distinguished. They're distinct from the rest of them. That can be a healthy thing sometimes or otherwise, but the fact is we do divide up that because we don't see eye to eye here. And this is what happened here, a very natural thing. This is tribal structure. It remains. Well, the word tribe, from tribus, Latin tribus, which means for the three, because it was always three. It was all, for everything that was done, it depends on a tribune. Our word tribune, that only refers, a tribune was only in charge of, was only the governor of one part of the people. He was the tribune, and he spoke from the tribunal, but that didn't affect the Senate at all. They didn't care. And the concert fathers didn't bother about that. The tribunes had their own things. They worked with the plebs. But there were the other tribes. There were the three tribes. The tribus, of course, means for the three. There were the three main tribes. But this structure goes on, and in Israel, after all, the first thing you ask, what are you? Are you of Ephraim? Are you of Manasseh? Are you of Judah? That's where the wars went on. That's where the politics went on between the 12 tribes, all through the Old Testament, right until they leave, and then it still goes on. So we're dealing with smaller groups within it, and this is a perfectly normal procedure we're having here. You have the fratries, you have parties, you have societies, you have deans. A person who is devoted to his lodge places that before everything else, you see, and that to him is sacred and so forth. So we don't have the single nation we think we do, and never have, never will have, because we have our various interests and our loyalties conflict. See, this is the essence of tragedy, of course, is conflicting loyalty. It's not the good guys against the bad guys, and the Book of Mormon keeps telling us that. We won't believe it. We say, yes, it's good guys versus bad guys, but the essence of tragedy is the incompatibility of two good things. Now, the great tragedies, the two great ones, the Oresteia and Oedipus, those two, the trilogy. We have the one trilogy, we don't have the other. What happens in the one case? person has the choice of his mother has killed his father, as you know, Orestes. Well, he's required by the ancient law to avenge his father's death. But you're not supposed to kill your mother, you see. So that's the tragic situation. How does he solve it? He goes mad. That's the only solution. He can't do it, you see. And it's the same thing with Orestes. He innocently married his mother, and also he killed his father. And he takes an oath to take a vengeance on the man who killed his father, who happens to be himself. When he found out, he wouldn't face it. He wouldn't face the facts, you see. Another case of man, he blinds himself. He doesn't go crazy the way Orestes. His solution is to blind himself, cut himself off completely from society, going off as a wanderer and a beggar, who had been the great king, goes off as a wanderer and a beggar in the land, because he can't reconcile the two conflicting principles and can't observe them both. So what are we going to do with these things? They're facing us constantly. This is the essence of tragedy, see? They're two good things. So here, they enter into a covenant. See, these people are quite solid among themselves. They had a secret government. We have secret government today. And when parties and interest groups, and we have underground things going on, we have covert operations, we even accept them as legitimate now, though, of course, by very nature, they're vicious and extremely dangerous, and very common in the Book of Mormon, you notice. So they enter into a covenant one with another. So they, and it was a covenant, they make it very secret, they're making a society, you see, which was given by them of old, which was given, administered by the devil to combine against all righteousness. They formed their own independent operation to get their release. And this is the way they only could get out of it, was to enter into a covenant to destroy them and to deliver those who were guilty of murder from the grasp of justice. They were going to, they were sanctioning, in fact, they were practicing, they were planning assassinations. That's what they were going to do. After all, this isn't the first time we've heard of judges being assassinated in the Book of Mormon. It had become routine practice, you know. Except certain hours, not from 10 to 12. You're not supposed to assassinate a judge from 10 to 12. Murder from the grasp of justice according to the law, according to the Constitution. They wanted their own law. They were, remember, these were just judges and lawyers. They did set at defiance the law of their country, but there were other laws, and that was the laws they were going to follow, as it says here. They did covenant one with another to destroy the governor and establish a king over the land. They're going all the way to get rid of their executive checks and limitations, and they succeed. And it's not surprising that they succeed, and the government that follows works pretty well. This is interesting. This shows us that all the time they've been divided up this way, that the infrastructure was already there for the tribals. They moved right into it. It didn't shatter the country or anything like that. Just as if we would give up the federal government, we'd still have states. That's what the Confederacy wanted. See, that's what we had the Civil War about. So here, they murdered the chief judge of the land, they destroyed him upon the judgment seat. That's the standard solution, neat and easy. And the people were divided one against another. They did separate from one another into tribes. Every man, they went off by themselves, every man, because the infrastructure was already set up. All you had to do was gather around you. In a crisis, that's what you do. You gather around your family. We had reduced it to the family shelter during the 1950s, which is an absurdity, of course, that every family is just for itself, and you get all the supplies you need, and above all, you supply yourself with weapons and make sure that nobody else shares what you have. That way you will survive a nuclear war. Everybody was nuts about that in 1950, believe it or not. The people who divided one against another and separated into tribes, see, every man according to his family, that's the nearest association, the safest, the one to take, and his kindred and friends, that's a little larger circle, the kindred relatives, the cousins and in-laws and so forth, and friends, they come into the circle, and thus they destroyed the government of the land. Everything out of control, and they went back and privatized everything and went back to the tribal system. Notice it says in the next verse, every tribe appointed a chief or a leader, and thus they became tribes. They're back to the old tribal government. I say they were ready for that all along, because we have this. We could do this today as far as that goes. In tribes, plenty of people here in Utah. I've known people like Clendenning and other groups up in Idaho and so forth that want to go off and live by themselves. And they do it. Things get pretty rough because they want to live absolute independent. You can't do that anymore. And their tribes became exceeding great. See, this infrastructure was already in place, so the tribes did become exceeding great. And there were no wars as yet. These tribes didn't fight with each other as yet. That will come later. And all this iniquity had come upon the people because they did yield themselves to the power of Satan. They just gave up. They stopped trying. You see, they started out being a righteous people, but you have to make an effort. You have to keep at it. Being righteousness is just not the absence, not what you don't do, but what you do do is what makes you righteous. I mean, you can't be righteous. As they say, there's no such thing being an idle righteous person. An idle person isn't righteous as far as that goes. You're not necessarily wicked or anything like that, but if you're going to be righteous, it's something you have to work at, because that's what we're here at, being tested. We're being tried and tempted, and it doesn't just stop when we've made one hurdle. There are more to follow. So they yield themselves to the power of Satan. They've given up trying. Notice the word is yield. They gave up. It wasn't that they were pushed into anything like that. They yielded to it. And the regulations of the government were destroyed. Well, that's exactly what, this privatization. They didn't like government regulations, so they got away with them. And it was the secret combination of friends and kindreds who murdered the prophets. They're behind this. Their unrestrained competition now. Great contention in the land, as you might well expect in the seventh verse here. Great contention in the land, insomuch that the more righteous part of the people has nearly all become wicked. Nearly all the righteous people, not just the wicked. We had plenty of wicked to begin with, but the righteous all became wicked. That's pretty bad. But few righteous among them. Everyone accepted the system and went along, you see. And thus 6 years had not passed since the more part of the people had turned from their righteousness. And it quotes the prophets here, like a dog to his vomit, like the sow to her wallowing in the mire. That's the Old Testament pattern here. Now, this secret combination, well, at the head of it, this powerful right-wing coalition had existed all along. They were the hardcore king people, it tells us there, the secret combination. They placed it themselves at their head, a man called Jacob, and to make him a king. But he wasn't accepted. People hated him. He didn't go over at all. They went too far, you see. These people did. And they were not so strong in number as the tribes of the people. They'd kept a nucleus there. These king people, the king men, kept a nucleus. But here, they weren't as strong as the number as the tribes of the people who were united together, save it where the leaders did establish their laws, each one according to his tribe. Now, they were united together. Notice they were the united tribes, but the leaders of each tribe established their own tribal laws, and they're the laws by which they live, everyone according to his tribe. Nevertheless, they were enemies. There was no love between them, but they were united in one thing, you see. Once the federal government had disappeared, they all regretted it. They missed it. They wished it was back, and they united only in hatred of the people that abolished it. One thing they had in common, they wanted to get it back again. They were united in the hatred of those who had entered into a covenant to destroy the government. They thought that was what they wanted. They didn't. And the plan backfired, in other words, and this is what happens here. Too late, they regret the loss of the central government, which has its virtues and has its necessity, too, as far as that goes. What are they going to do? Well, the king people were very unpopular, and Jacob skipped out. He got out as fast as he could. Therefore, he commanded his people to fly to the northernmost part of the land. See, the north is the frontier. That's as far as when you want to get out. The northernmost part of the land, and build up their kingdom there. They were going up there where they'd be left alone and build up a kingdom, and he would be king. The dissenters would go and join them. That's the old pattern, you see. We've seen that in the Book of Mormon. The Nehor started out, yes?
What was the church doing at this point in time?
The church wasn't. The church was gathered. It says there were a few gathered around Nephi, and it was still going. It was still there, but it was almost underground as far as this goes. We'll see what happens to it. They got away with it. Notice, so speedy was their march that they couldn't be impeded, and they went out and settled by themselves. Here's another this racial problem. See, here's another stock moving out. They're a mixed stock. They're going out by themselves. They become independent. You got another tribe here. For long, they'd be speaking, well, they must be speaking a different dialect already as far as that goes. Dialects and languages, that's the difference. And so here's the ideal of splinter groups, the 14th, notice. And they were divided into tribes, every man according to his family and kindred and friends. It emphasizes, because it's very important. See, this chapter actually tells us about the end of the Nephite state. It's the end. This is where the book should end if something isn't about to happen. And with big things about to happen now. When it reaches this stage, you can expect something to pop. Nevertheless, they'd come to an agreement not to go to war with one. And that was sensible, not to go to war with another. That's more sensible than we have been, you see. Now we're finally agreeing that you're not going to gain anything by that. But they were not united as to their laws. They were governed according to the minds of their chiefs. They were governed by chiefs and their leaders. But they had very strict laws that one tribe should not trespass against another. The territorial bounds were respected, as is always the case, even with animals. You know, if the animals, wolves and foxes and so forth, have their territories. And of course, the most lawless people in the world are the Arab Bedouins of the desert, who can, the Khazza, they live by the Khazza, they live by raiding what they can get and so forth. But nevertheless, they live very strictly, they observe, even in the desert, there are certain tribal boundaries, certain limitations, and you can't go over the boundaries. And this is what they had, these tribal bounds. And of course, the main cause of wars between tribes is infringing on the other's boundary. And the European wars, for that matter, France and Germany, all their arguments have been about boundaries. Alsace-Lorraine, you see the line where it was, the Netherlands, so forth, the Austria. Who owns what? But the same thing, but they had these strict, they're not going to last very long, but it's the proper arrangement, it's the way things were done. Very strict laws that one tribe should not trespass against another, insomuch that in some degree they had peace in the land. Well, they were not absolute fools, but they did stone the prophet, so the church was there and having a rough time. It came to pass that Nephi, having been visited by angels, now we have to have the deus ex machina. Something has to intervene at this moment, because they've reached rock bottom now. What's going to move them off dead center here? This is the end. I say it was the end of the book, if it hadn't been for the intervention of something else. Visited by angels and also the voice of the Lord, having seen angels and being an eyewitness and having the power given to him that he might know concerning these things. Now, and that he might know concerning the ministry of Christ, being eyewitness to their quick return to righteousness unto wickedness, and their quick return from righteousness, notice how quick it was, always emphasizing the speed, from righteousness unto their wickedness and abominations. These lightning switches impress you, they impress the writer no less. He thinks it's quite strange. And they're grieved, and they went forth among the people and tried to do something, but it didn't pay off. Nephi had power and great authority, but they were angry with him, during the 18th verse, for it were not possible that they could disbelieve his words. They knew he was right, and that made them furious. So great was his faith on Jesus Christ that angels did minister unto him daily. These extreme conditions require extreme measures, don't they? We have them here. In the name of Jesus, he cast out devils, and his brother did the same, and they raised people from the dead. And when the people saw that, they were angry. What was the mortal offense of Jesus? That when the elders of the Jews and the high priests and the Levites and the elders of the Jews came together and decided there was only one solution to the problem, and that was to put Jesus to death, get him out of the way. That was when he raised Lazarus. That was the thing that decided it. You can go back and look there, and everything, they put up with everything, but when he raised Lazarus from the dead, that was too much. And they decided that he would have to be put to death. The doctors came together then. And it's the same thing here. When the people saw it, they were angry with him because of his power. And notice here, the 21st verse, you ask, where was the church? Here it is. The passage, there were but few who were converted unto the Lord, but as many as were converted did truly signify unto the people that they had been visited by the power and Spirit of God. So the church was active, small, persecuted, and so forth. It was in Jesus Christ in whom they believed. And they had many, and here's an account of what went on in the church. They had their miracles, the casting out of devils, and their testimonies. And they would have you remember that there were none who were brought into repentance who were not baptized. So anyone who was repentant got baptized, so the church was growing. They were ordained of Nephi, men unto this ministry. Nephi had ordained others, so the church was growing, and they were baptizing people. And they should be baptized with water for the remission of sins. And there were many in the commencement of this year who were baptized. So just before the big disaster, many were baptized. Well, the church was growing. Things were going all right. Then, not too all right. But now we come to the exciting thing. Now we come to the wham-bang part of it. And you notice how cleverly it introduces it. I mean, with what tension. He's about to report something that may test our credulity here. So he begins with an ominously subdued modesty to the whole thing, a very matter-of-fact tone. It came to pass that according to our record, he wants to make sure we get it right, and we know our record to be true. Behold, it was a just man who did keep the record, so he wouldn't make anything crooked. That's very important, you see. He did many miracles. It came to pass, if there is no mistake, he keeps the next verse, he always, this, you see, we must get this absolutely right, what we're talking about here. There's no mistake made by this man in the reckoning of our time. The 33rd year passed away, And the people began to look with great earnestness for the sign, the 33rd year. And this is building up the tension, you see. And there began to be great doubtings and disputations among the people, a feeling of uncertainty. Well, will it happen or won't it? Well, this had happened before at the birth of Christ, the same way, you know, when they pronounced a Bartholomew's Eve for all those who believe. The first month, on the fourth day of the month, there arose a great storm. It starts out now, things are beginning to happen. It always hits suddenly, and it begins on low key here. And then, pow, did shake the whole earth as if it were to divide asunder. Again, I'll refer to something here. It'll save us time. If you go into books on earthquakes and check this up, you'll see the order of the events is all very correct and accurate. Now, this is rather important because we used to think, and in my childhood, they used to refer to missionaries and so forth. Used to, as proof to the Book of Mormon, they'd refer to the Rocky Mountains or the Sierras, you see. See, because the Book of Mormon says mountains are cast up. There are mountains, all right, so that proves the Book of Mormon. Well, that's absurd. That's not what the Book of Mormon tells us at all. The Book of Mormon just describes a number 12 earthquake. Maybe number 8 on the Richter scale might do it. But the Assam earthquake in 1950, August 9, was 12 on the scale. Remember, every time you go up a number, you double the strength of the earthquake. So you can imagine what a 12 would be if the last San Francisco earthquake was 7.5 at the extreme. So this is some earthquake, and the order in which the events are described is very good here. All the things that should take place. So we've summed them up here in the this very factual count. Well, it was a terror, about 12 or 11 on the Wood-Newman scale. Probably not the worst earthquake on record, because Assam was total destruction, and this one, we're told, there were some cities which remained. It was not total. Just at the, it describes what happens at the center, the epicenter, see. But there are cities that remained, and whereas in the great Assam earthquake of 1950, the damage was total over a large area. I'm going to read you an account of that Assam earthquake. It was my friend George Allen, who owns that bookstore, the oldest bookstore in America, in Philadelphia. He married a princess of Assam at this time. The news came through. We heard a lot about Assam. Assam is in the northeast corner of the Himalayas there. And in 1950, August the 15th, there was an earthquake that was total there. Over 10,000 square miles and 500,000 people. Only 14 people survived. Imagine an earthquake, 500,000 people over that area. Well, here's a description of it. On the morning of August the 15th, 1950, the day of the biggest and strangest earthquake in our times, it gave no inkling it was to come. All of a sudden, just this terrible storm and then the earthquake. All of a sudden, all the seismographs in the world went mad. This was terrific. The instruments had gone completely crazy. Nobody was able to locate it. It took a couple of days to discover where it was because the shocks went round and round and round the earth. It was so great. In hundreds of seismological stations throughout the world, astonished scientists were reading that message from the greatest earthquake since the birth of modern seismology 50 years ago. Well, the energy unleashed was the equivalent of 3 million atom bombs of the Bikini model. Stranger things were to follow. By all the rules, the scene of the cataclysm should have been invaded by reporters, scientists, and relief workers. Nothing. It was just wiped out completely. Instead, they didn't even have to bother to... They were afraid of the Chinese going, that's the Chinese border with Tibet, you know. No worry after that. The map had completely changed. Where there had been rivers before, there were mountains now. Rivers that ran in one direction, they now ran in the opposite direction. These things happen. We've seen something a few years ago were happening like that, and just a couple of years ago down in San Pete County, where mountains were moving backwards. But this is sudden, you see. Instead, the tortured mountains, the homeless rivers, the vanished villages have remained undisturbed since that awful thing happened. The quake just lasted 8 minutes, but took 3 years for it to subside. So it was 3 hours here, remember, it went on for 3 hours, but then for 3 days it continued to shake. So the aftershocks went on for 3 days, and the big one was 3 hours. It took over 3 years for the forces of destruction to run their course here. Its intensity 12, or in the terse language of the Wood-Newman scale, damage total. Beyond stretched a vast area of lesser destruction. Then some 10,000 square miles home to an estimated 500,000 people, were turned into a wilderness of desolation. This scientist was sent in to investigate. He says, I have traced only 14 eyewitnesses from that, that survived from that. He had to run them down. It was fantastic, quantities of rock and so forth. The here's the Assam rifles. They were in position on one of the mountains, and the commander gave them at the start, gave the order for his men to secure their mules, but not one man was able to stand up or walk. They could not even crawl. Several vomited as if violently sick. A gaping fissure opened up before their eyes, 10 feet wide, 20 feet deep, an unknown length. Then the worst shocks were over. After nearly 10 minutes, four soldiers and a mule could be seen at the bottom of the chasm. The men cried for help, but before anything could be done, the fissure filled up with yellow-brown, sulfurous-smelling mud, and the men and the mules disappeared. Well, you know, on the sort of this basin, this part of the basin, especially over the Mammoth, the other side of the basin, these things are happening now. And places that they had made subdivisions and were going to develop have been completely abandoned now because of the fissures that are breaking and the hot springs that are suddenly bursting out, fumaroles and things like that. It's like Sodom and Gomorrah, that the south end of the Dead Sea did the same thing. Well, this is one thing that's stressed in the Book of Mormon, too, oh boy. One thing is stressed in all reports, the awful rumble that heralded the outbreak of the quake. The noise, muffled at first, seemed to come out of the very bowels of the earth. Birds rose on the wing with a rustle and a flutter. People stood or crouched motionless as the noise grew in volume until it reached a deafening roar, louder than anything any of the witnesses had ever heard before. Well, the Book of Mormon talks about that. At this point, the ground began to move. In the earthquake center, it moved with a rapidly increasing vertical vibration. People, cattle, rocks, and small buildings were tossed into the air like peas on an enormous kettle drum, a phenomenon rare in most earthquakes. The ground, the solid mountain-like grain between two giant millstones. This is your Book of Mormon description, too, you see. Strong winds raised the dust till visibility was reduced to a few feet. Of course, this terrible darkness is described here. And breathing became a nightmare. There was a monastery of Lamaist monks up there, and when the monks tried to resume contact with the outer world, they found that the earthquake had seemingly transported them to a faraway place. The same thing happened after the earthquake. Remember, they all met at the temple and marveling at the whole land had changed. They didn't recognize anything. Well, here it is again. That the earthquake, so faraway place, that for their sins they had been reincarnated together with their immediate surroundings on some desolate planet devoid of all other human life. As they probed the howling wilderness around them, there was not one landmark, even faintly reminiscent of the country they had known so well. Where there had been a mountain summit with sheer cliff-like rocks rising for hundreds of feet, there was now a scooped-out bowl of dust of a curious pink color. Rivers had disappeared. Others had sprung up and were running in the opposite directions, where the old surface of the land would have been uphill. And so, it goes on here, other things. And of course, the fires, the, well, it changed the whole map of things here. Halfway through the earthquake, countless craterlets, 1 to 3 feet in diameter, opened up on a low-lying land and spouted great quantities. Remember, in 1812, the great earthquake in central United States was as bad as this, when a whole area of 10,000, oh, more than 10,000 square miles, sunk 30 feet. The whole central United States, from Tennessee west there. And this says, opening up low-lying land and spouting great quantities of sand and water. The phenomenon was natural enough, for the alternate tensions and compressions of the ground opened fissured, thus sucking down the groundwater, and on them the fissures closed, sand and water were forced violently out of the miniature volcanoes and so forth, and when the river broke through. Well, the Book of Mormon description is one of the best. In the report by Assam's superintending engineer, it was stated, the Kanjalun River, usually 150 feet wide, 5 feet deep, is now totally silted up. There's not the slightest trace of a channel. Water covers the surrounding countryside for miles. The Sisi River, usually 250 feet wide and 20 feet deep, there's a real river, has vanished totally without a trace. Great river. And so it goes. These things happen. And then the animals come, because this is Moses, the book of Moses, remember? And the roar, there was an earthquake, and it shook, and the roar of lions was heard from the wilderness. And this is what happened, too. He suddenly, when the snakes came out of the jungle, they thought they were going mad. The snakes soon drifted away, but the elephants and tigers continued for weeks to terrorize the distraught natives. Again, the SM rivals came to the rescue and so forth. But he saw, here's this, the treasure of a tea factory, a Mojur, in Upper Lung, Langipur, had taken refuge in a deserted Shiva temple when the snakes arrived. The jungle lion was about 300 yards away, he said. As I sat on the ruins, I suddenly thought I'd gone mad. Out of the jungle, there came one great slithering mass of snakes, thousands of them. As they came closer, I recognized them as hemidryads, krites, bamboo snakes, and common cobras, all of them venomous and deadly and so forth. What a pretty picture, eh? But the thing is, these things happen on such a scale. But the description in the Book of Mormon is remarkable, not for its spectacular and tremendous nature, but for its restraint. It says nothing that isn't characteristic of a big earthquake. It wasn't the worst. I'd put it about 8, because lots of places survived, lots of people survived and so on. But the description of the various phenomena that accompanied the tsunamis and the others, because this was on the coast, this wasn't, you see. But this was on the coast, so you have the tsunamis, the cities buried under sea, and the commonest cause of destruction being fire, which is the common cause, and so forth and so on. Well,